The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Good evening. Welcome to tonight's book show. Joining us back on the show is Nadia Cohen, who's written numerous biographies, including The Real Enid Blyton and The Extraordinary Life of A.A. Milne. Her latest, The Real Roald Dahl, reveals some of the little-known events that shaped his life and work. Also with us is Stephen Cox, who's worked for various not-for-profits, most notably for 12 years with Great Ormond Street Hospital. His novel, Our Child of the Stars, is a story of warmth, tenacity and generosity of spirit, set against the backdrop of the 60s, when war is raging in Vietnam and the superpowers are threatening each other with annihilation. Also on the show is Alexander Hall, who earned a PhD at Cambridge and spent much of his working life in Germany as a teacher and as an exam centre manager. His second novel, The Woven Figure, is set during the financial crisis of 2008 and explores some dark themes, as well as looking at marriage and family life. And finally on today's book show is Hannah Jameson, who wrote her first book at the age of 17. Q magazine described her as writing like an angel on speed. Now age 28, The Last is her first novel for Penguin, and the world has ended. 20 survivors remain in a hotel. One of them is a killer. That's all on tonight's book show on Talk Radio Europe.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Open up the dirty window, let the sun illuminate the words that you could not find. Reaching for something in the distance, so close you can almost taste it. Release your inhibitions, feel the rain on your skin. No one else can feel it for you, only you can let it in. No one else, no one else can speak the words on your lips. Treat yourself in words unspoken, live your life.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is Nadia Cohen. She's an author who's written numerous historical and contemporary biographies. We had her on a few months ago talking about The Extraordinary Life of A.A. Milne and The Real Enid Blyton. We have her on again because she has another book out, The Real Roald Dahl. It's a book about a very famous, seemingly lovely children's storyteller who actually hid a darker side behind the public facade. Welcome to the book show, Nadia.
Hi, Hannah. Thank you for having me back.
It's a pleasure to have you back. It really is. You did say last time we spoke that you were doing a book about Roald Dahl, and I said, no, I love Roald Dahl.
Yeah, I'm sorry about this. Lots of people have had the same reaction. He's much loved all over the world, not just in Britain. Everybody seems to adore him, and there's no reason to stop loving him.
No. No,
that's not that bad.
he's had a really tragic life in part, hasn't he? He's had some really awful times family-wise.
Yeah, I think this was the problem. He kind of got a reputation as being a bit of a cantankerous, moody old bugger, really. But I think the problem was he was in a lot of physical pain for many years of his life. He was in a plane crash when he was a young RAF fighter pilot in the Second World War, and messed up his spine badly and had a series of operations to try and rectify it, but nothing was ever quite worked. And he was in a lot of pain, and people thought he was just bad-tempered and angry, but I think he was never quite comfortable. It was one chair in which he could get comfortable. He had to sit at a desk with sort of, he couldn't even sit at a desk, sorry, he had to have a board across a chair to write at. And I think as a result, he got a reputation for always being in a bad mood.
Well, I imagine that a lot of people, if they're in constant pain, it would be a struggle, wouldn't it?
Of course, exactly. And everybody thought, oh, he had angry temper tantrums and outbursts and very negative opinions. He had a reputation for being anti-Semitic, for being racist, for being a misogynist. And lots of things he said did back that up. But I think he was just in agony a lot of the time. He was also blighted by a series of tragedies that struck his family. He lost his daughter when she was just 7 to a bout of measles, which they were offered medicine, and she didn't take it. So he felt guilty for the rest of his life that he could have perhaps saved her life. His son was in a terrible accident when he was a baby in a pram and had his skull smashed in and then never quite recovered, at a series of behavioural and learning difficulties. His wife had a terrible stroke, which she needed to be nursed from. His sister had died years earlier when she was just 7 as well. So he felt that his life was always affected by illness, tragedy and loss.
He thought that his family was cursed, didn't he, at one point?
Exactly, yeah. And it did kind of look like that. I mean, there was a series of brain hemorrhages, which of course are very unusual, and yet it affected his family 3 or 4 times. So he started to think there was something wrong, and he dedicated a big portion of his life to trying to fix brain problems. And he invented this tiny little mechanism for children to put in their brains. It was called the dull till tap. It was like a little tap which little kids could have in their brain to try and help ease the pressure after brain surgery. So as well as all of his children's writing and literature, he actually was concerned about trying to make medical advances. And when his wife was sick, he devoted himself to a timetable of ways to get her well as well. He did feel very like he was cursed and that he had to try and change it himself.
It's really
quite sad when you look back on it.
Definitely. And the story about his daughter is awful, because as you say, they didn't give medicine to her. They only had one lot of medicine available, which they chose to give to Theo, their son, who was the one who'd had all these medical problems. They thought, well, he's the one who's likely to get it. But then it was Olivia who got it, and she died from it. And he obviously felt that he could have done more to protect her.
It is terrible. And Theo was very vulnerable because he was in and out of hospital after this awful accident. He was thrown from his pram by a bus. A very dramatic, tragic accident. And Roald recalled being in his office and hearing the sirens. It's when they were living in Manhattan. And not realizing they were for his baby. So that haunted him. And then when they were offered one dose of medicine, of course they gave it to the very vulnerable little boy who had been in and out of hospital, not thinking that his daughter, who was at school at the time, was also risk of infection from other kids, so she got it. And then he just felt that he should have given it to her. It was awful. He was very introverted for the rest of his life after that, and haunted by these things.
He didn't have a great marriage with Patricia, did he? It was sort of doomed from the start, it seems.
Yeah, well, she apparently met him on the rebound. She was in love with someone else, and on the wedding night she said, we shouldn't be doing this, this is a mistake, and she recalled lying awake all night crying. But he was apparently a deeply sexual man, and that's all he cared about. Whenever she was emotional, he would sort of try and rectify it like that. And he just, that was all he cared about. He sort of ignored her, and she threw herself into motherhood, had 3 or 4 children back to back very quickly. But then when she had the stroke, I think he lost interest in her. He didn't think she was sexy anymore. He found another woman who he was attracted to and asked Patricia for permission to have an affair with her, which seems like a pretty bold move. Of course, she said no. And he honored that, but he was haunted for years about desperately trying to be with this woman, trying to find a way that they could be together. And eventually, finally, Patricia left and he could be with Felicity, who became his second wife. But he was quite self-centered, I think, when it came to women. He didn't really care what she wanted. He just wanted what he wanted.
And you mentioned the anti-Semitism earlier. He did say some pretty awful things, didn't he?
He did. And he had a reputation for it. His publishers in New York, a lot of the big bosses there were Jewish businessmen who suspected that he had an anti-Semitic streak to him, but they sort of ignored it because he was so successful. He was their big star author, and they sort of turned a blind eye to it. But eventually, when he did write something in the newspaper which seemed to be sympathizing with Hitler, people turned on him, and he'd never really got over it. He never really tried to explain or apologise for it. I think that was pretty much how he thought. But there was, you know, he had a bad side, he had a dark side, but he had lots of good qualities too.
Yes. Tell us about some of his good qualities.
Well, he was hugely entertaining. I mean, people who met him recalled him being quite intimidating. He'd have big, loud dinner parties and he would quiz people on their morals, and he would question people and really grill people and put them through their paces, which I think if you were in any way shy or retiring, you might have found very intimidating. But he could also be great fun, very entertaining. He'd end every meal with, he'd produce a big box of chocolate bars. He could afford lobster and caviar and fine wine, but then at the end of the meal it would always be sort of Mars bars and Aeros and Twixes and things. So he never really lost his schoolboy sense of fun and fascination, especially with sweets. And he was very entertaining, and all his children have lovely memories of him trying to create magical times for them and telling these wonderful stories. And of course, you know, all these stories that we remember him from, they were based on their bedtime stories, so it must have been very magical being one of his children, I would imagine.
Oh, that's so nice to hear, because it was the opposite when we talked about Enid Blyton, wasn't it? She gave all that to her fans, but not her children.
Yeah, I think Roald did his best to be a good father, and I think he felt that he was never quite good enough for them, and they rebelled. And Tessa, who was the mother of the supermodel Sophie Dahl, she went through a very rebellious stage of going out with much older men, and she got pregnant before she was married, and she turned against, she discovered his affair and turned against him, and they had quite a rocky relationship for quite a few years. But then they patched it up, and I think he always wanted towards the end of his life to be surrounded by his kids. Family was very important to him. He just wanted a quiet life. And that's why he sort of retired to his house in the country, gypsy house in Buckinghamshire, and he just wanted to be left in peace, I think, and to write. He tried lots of other types of writing. He tried adult stories. Of course, he did his Tales of the Unexpected, his creepy, dark adult stories, but it was always what he was best loved for, was the kids' stories. And I think he was glad that he was able to bring happiness to children. He enjoyed that, I think.
Yeah, and interesting that you say at the end of the meal he produced all this chocolate, considering he wrote Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
Yeah, that exactly. I mean, that was, everybody said that the character most closely resembled Roald himself was Willy Wonka, this eccentric, slightly dark, slightly nutty, but childlike character, which is probably the closest to the man himself. When he was a schoolboy, he hated being at boarding school. He'd grown up in rural Wales and in Norway, where he had lots of freedom, and then suddenly he's packed off to this very gloomy, uptight English boarding school with outdoor toilets and bullying, and he absolutely hated it. And the only joy he had was there was a chocolate factory nearby, where once a term they would send the boys a box of chocolate bars to test new ones, new ideas, and were given a feedback form to say, what do you think of each bar? And that absolutely fascinated him. It was the highlight of his term. It led him to wonder who was coming up with these new ideas. Who was it in the factory whose job it was to create new flavours, new tastes? And that was, of course, the seed of Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. And that became his most successful story and what we probably most people best remember him for. Mm. But it was all based on reality and based on the idea that some clever inventor that was actually a real job for somebody.
Yes.
Which was fabulous.
Absolutely. And yeah. I also remember his book, Boy, Tales of Childhood, was one of, if not the first, autobiography that I ever read, and remember being fascinated by, you know, having loved his stories as a child and his poems and things like that, still really enjoying him as a writer in non-fiction terms, talking about his life. And when he taught one of the most famous chapters, I think, that a lot of people remember if they've read the book, is when he goes to the sweet shop and talks about the old lady in the sweet shop and
her mouth.
Yeah, exactly. Just brilliant.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, he always thought that autobiographies were nonsense and a complete waste of time and just a collection of facts. And why would anybody want to read a collection of facts when they could read a story?
Mm.
So he always resisted doing one. But then when he did, it turns out later that it was wildly exaggerated. But as a result, it was hugely entertaining. Some of the facts, some of the dates and things were a bit muddled up. But, of course, the great mouse plot,
yes.
Everybody claims did happen, where he secretly put dropped a dead mouse into a jar of sweets. So the owner dropped the jar, sweets went everywhere, she screamed. But as a result, he got very badly beaten by his headmaster. He was given the cane, and his mother was so horrified when she saw the marks on his back that she took him out of the school. So it had quite a sad ending to a very funny story, but there remains a blue plaque on the outside of that sweet shop to this day. It's now a Chinese takeaway, but locals still remember it as the scene of the daring mouse plot.
Oh, wow. What a shame it's now a Chinese takeaway. That's so funny. I hope they have a Chinese dish dedicated to rolled dal.
Hopefully not with a dead mouse inside.
Yes, exactly. Well, if people want to get a copy of The Real Rolled Dal, it is out now and available to buy on our website in the bookshop section. It's by Nadia Cohen, who we've been chatting to. Nadia, thank you so much for joining us again.
Pleasure. Thanks, Hannah.
The Book Programme. Presented by Hannah Murray. This is Talk Radio Europe. The Book Programme. Presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is Stephen Cox, who was born in the USA and now lives in London. He's worked for various not-for-profits, most notably for 12 years with Great Ormond Street Hospital. He's with us on the book show to talk about his book, Our Child of the Stars. It's a remarkable story of warmth, tenacity and generosity of spirit set against the backdrop of a fast-changing, terrifying decade. Welcome to the book show, Stephen.
Good morning.
Hi, thanks very much for joining us. And what an interesting story, I feel. Where did the inspiration for it all come from?
Well, I was thinking about writing a story for Halloween, and the characters, the three main characters, popped into my head, which was a mother. It's set in America in the 1960s, a mother, the father, and a child they've adopted who turns out not to be human. And a lot of the feel of the book comes from books I've been reading, my life, the stories my mother used to tell about America and so forth. So it's got quite a lot of things flowing into it.
And did you come up with the idea of the characters before the story, or the other way around?
What really happened is that a couple of scenes came into my head. And so in a sense, the mother and the child were pretty much formed as I was working in that first day or so. And then it built out, because obviously I needed to know, why was Corey the boy there? Why was he in danger? Why had Jean and Molly's marriage been in difficulty? So I had to work backwards and forwards from that scene to write the whole book. I mean, inspiration is quite a complicated thing, because, you know, there are things you know where they come from, there are things that you eventually figure out where they come from, and there are things you never quite understand where they come from.
And how about the setting, the year of Woodstock, and set in the States?
I knew it was going to be nostalgic. I've been reading some Ray Bradbury, who's an author I love, and he has this very way of writing stuff that's tender and dark and humorous and nostalgic. And so I'd read a couple of his books recently, reread them, and I felt that that was the tone I was going for, and it became very clear as I was writing it that it was set in the 60s, in that great time of change in Britain and the US, and that, you know, the Vietnam War was there as a theme which both Molly and Jean are very much against. And then gradually, as I wrote the book, I sort of firmed up which exact year it was set in. So it's an interesting time, because the interesting thing about the 60s, which I was a kid in the 60s, is that a lot of the big issues of the 60s, war and peace, is the government telling us the truth, the role of women, racial justice, all those themes are still with us. And the 60s set off explosions, and, you know, the debris is still falling from some of those. There was a big conservative backlash. Nixon famously got re-elected by a landslide. So all those interesting issues flowed into the book.
And did you have to do a fair bit of research for it all?
I tend to research as I go along. So I went through and I had to check things like, you know, is it realistic that they would have an answering machine or not? And, you know, I mean, I quite like some of that chunkiness of reminding people that there were payphones that you put coins in. And if you're out on the road, in a car, there's no way anyone can contact you. Actually, for plot reasons, setting a book before the mobile phone is often very handy. But yes, and you know, what music that would be playing on the radio. I mean, the music was a really exciting part of this, because I thought to myself I knew 60s music quite well, and I wrote the entire book over several years with the same tracks playing endlessly, because they are so of the time. It was so much about the music, and the music almost ends up becoming a character in the book.
Oh, fantastic. So tell us a bit more about Corey.
Well, it's a Gene and Molly are going about their everyday business when a meteor lands and destroys, it damages the town, it destroys miles of forest to the north of the town. And when Molly is a nurse, so when she goes into work, she, in a very dramatic scene, she said, right, we have this child has turned up who is actually an alien, and we have no idea how to feed him, we have no idea how to keep him alive. So she immediately sees a very startling looking kid and has to decide, you have to look after him and defend him. And it soon becomes very apparent that there are lots of forces that will be very interested in him, but not interested in him for his own sake. So they have to make that decision. Corey himself is a bundle of fun. I mean, he's just bursting with energy and enthusiasm for this new world, grieving that, in fact, his mother has died, his biological mother has died in bringing him to Earth, excited by the world. And he is actually like a Candide figure, because he has no knowledge of Earth. He sees human beings as from a different perspective than we do, and in the way that children do, speak some painful truths about humanity and some of its shortcomings. So the book isn't at all preachy. I think that would be very off-putting, but certainly by the end of the book, you know, we start to see how Corey's perspective might be one we need to think about.
Yeah. And was it fun kind of getting into the mind of Corey, being the fact that he's just sort of arrived from wherever,
yeah,
and, you know, not being the mind of a normal boy? You could really, I guess, go to town and make him think, yeah, however you wanted him to.
Yes, I think that's very, yeah, the dilemma that you always have in trying to write a book is to how alien you can make an alien and make them put people off. People have to empathize with him. He has to have emotional responses that we understand. But on the other hand, if he was basically a boy in a mask, if all it was, if you looked a little bit different physically. So there were things I wove in that were things that are needed for the plot. There were things I wove in that were telling us a little bit about him, because of course you can't be confused by our world without having some sense of what his world is like. And I think, yes, I have to say I had a lot of fun writing this book. It was fun to decide what things he would misunderstand, and he just has got a great bubbling sense of humour, and enjoys a lot of the things that children do. One of the things I wanted to write about was, I'm a parent myself, was the way that having children, when you take time to think about it, actually allows you to relive childhood, to see the world again as a child, and to enjoy that view of the world as new and special and strange. So I got a lot of fun out of writing him, actually.
And I guess doing a lot of work with Great Ormond Street Hospital as well, you've spent a lot of time around children.
Yes, I think that I was helping them run their communications department, so it was not hands-on healing people, but so several things flow into it. I mean, they're scene set in the hospital and so on. But I think one of the crucial things was me dealing with photographers, and usually they were grey. But occasionally you would have people say, that child looks too old, that child looks too strange. And of course, that child was a child, actually. You know, there was no hierarchy of beauty or appropriateness. And, you know, that got us in the comms team fairly angry, as you might expect. And so that's one of the reasons why I'm not going to say what Corey looks like, because it's very clearly described in the first chapter of the book. But he is not, he doesn't look entirely human. and he doesn't look, by our standards, beautiful. That was quite deliberate. And it's, I got a bit of pushback from that in trying to get the book published. People said, can you make him a bit prettier? And obviously I said no, because of the reason I've made him a bit odd-looking.
Mm.
You actually see the relationship, because it opens with Molly sewing Corey's Halloween costume. You actually understand the relationship between Molly and Corey before you actually see Corey, and that's quite deliberate.
And have you already decided what you're going to do with your next book? Has it kind of inspired you to do a similar story, similar thing, or something completely different?
Well, the funny thing is that both my editor and I sort of thought I was going to try something else, but always leave open the option of doing a second book about Corey and his family. Now, the interesting thing is we got to the end of the edit, which is quite a wearying process of, you know, various depths and degrees of editing. And by the time both of us had finished the edit, we were not only not tired of the first book, but my editor suggested to me that we write another book for the second one. So I'm doing a sequel.
It's going to be
a standalone. The intention is that you should be able to read it without having read the first one, because I like my books to have some sort of standalone character to them. But it is very closely following the family on from the first book. So and people are already reviewing it and tweeting and asking if there's going to be another one.
Oh, great.
So, the good news is there is going to be another one.
Fantastic. Well, if people want to read the first one, it's called Our Child of the Stars. It's by Stephen Cox, who we've been chatting to. It's available to buy on our bookshop section on our website, tre.radio. Stephen, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for your time.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
TRE.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is Alexander Hall, who grew up in a military family and has lived in several European countries. After earning a PhD at Cambridge, he spent much of his working life in Germany as a teacher and exam centre manager. He currently divides his time between London and Hamburg. He's with us on the book show to talk about his second novel, The Woven Figure. It's set during the financial crisis of 2008. Welcome to the book show, Alexander.
Thank you very much for inviting me, Hannah.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you for joining us. I was reading up about your book and it occurred to me that the financial crisis of 2008 was 10 years ago now.
That was one of the reasons why I wanted to write about it, because it seemed to me that it had such a profound effect on lots of people's lives. And 10 years on, now that the dust has begun to settle, we can see just what havoc it caused in so many different countries.
Yes, absolutely. And not just for businesses, but also for families and relationships as well, which comes very much into your book.
Exactly. It starts with the money and it ends with the money, doesn't it? People depended so much on the banks, and without banks being able to lend money to small businesses and entrepreneurs, people had to give up on all their hopes and ambitions.
Mm. Now, I know in the book there's a cast of characters spanning three generations, but there's a sort of main couple, isn't there? Lawrence and Rosie.
That's correct, yes.
Tell us about them.
Well, to some extent, the hero of my novel, Lawrence, is one of Thatcher's children. One of the advantages of living in a country that is not the country that you regard as your home base, in other words, the UK, is that you can take a detached view of what is going on. And during the Thatcher years, I was living in Germany, and I observed many of the trends and the developments of that time. Lawrence is one of Thatcher's children in the sense that for him, life is all about getting on and making money, being someone, having a material base that you can point to show other people, not just those within your own family, what you have achieved. And this is one of the key things about Lawrence as a character. He wants to be able to point to status symbols. He wants to show people that he's got on in life and been a success.
Mm. And he and his wife, Rosie, so that they appear to have it all, as it were.
Yes, this is one of the more traditional aspects of Lawrence as a character. He wants to be the traditional figure who provides family. Rosie is very much in his shadow. She's quite different in the sense that she's not ambitious in quite the way that he is. And he wants to impress her with the things that he's able to give her and give the family as well.
Mm. So, without giving too much away, can you tell us a little bit about what goes wrong or what happens to them?
What we haven't yet mentioned is that Lawrence is in property management, and this again is one of the typical obsessions about life in the UK that foreigners often comment on. People put all their savings into bricks and mortar, they move into smaller properties, they do them up, they very often become property developers. And this is something that Lawrence does. He starts off as an estate agent, and then he becomes independent. He sets up his own company. And one of the things that he's very keen to do is to move up the property scale himself. And he expects that his family will follow him wherever he goes. And this is one of the first mistakes that he makes. His family is settled. His wife is happy where they are. The children are happy in their school. But what he leaves out of account is that you can't just move up the property scale and imagine that you'll get everybody in the family to follow you without talking about it within the family. And that is really the next main problem, that being a typical male, he's not very good at communicating, and he certainly doesn't communicate with his wife about what he wants to do.
Mm. And there is some tragedy that happens in the book as well.
Yes, indeed. No book is complete without some tragedy.
And can you tell us about some of the other characters then?
Lawrence is an orphan, in the sense that he never really knew his father. His father was in the Merchant Navy. His father died when he was quite young. And so he's been brought up by his mother. And he gets a lot of the ambition from his mother because she's fiercely protective of her son, but at the same time, she goads him all the time into achieving more things for himself and for his family. And she is, in one sense, a rather dark presence. What I mean by that is that we don't know that much about her own background. It's filtered through in a number of different ways in the novel. But he regards her presence in his life as something of a problem, simply because she tends to interfere directly and indirectly. That impacts on the relationship that he has with Rosie, his wife, and Rosie doesn't really like her mother-in-law. And there's a lot of tension that goes on within those three characters, between Lawrence and his mother, between Rosie and her mother-in-law. And these three characters really form a kind of triad in the novel.
Mm. And it looks at the sort of in the middle generation as well, that this couple, Lawrence and Rosie, presumably are those people caught between having teenage offspring and aging parents, which I'm sure a lot of people can relate to.
Yes, I mean, the family is one of those interesting units that we spend our lives observing. It's the main social unit that we grow up in, of course. And many people are blessed with loving parents and grandparents, and they look back on their upbringing in a very fond way. but I've always been conscious of something that I recall hearing when I was still a student in the late 60s. There was a social anthropologist, a man called Edmund Leach, who gave some of the BBC Reith lectures. And I've always remembered one of the key ideas that he presented in that series of lectures. And what he said was that far from being the basis of the good society, the family with its narrow privacy and tawdry secrets is the source of all our discontents. And if you stop to analyze what he said, you realize that we build up all these hopes and aspirations for the future, very often because of the pressures that are put upon us by our parents or sometimes others in the family unit. I mean, middle siblings find it quite difficult simply making their own way in their lives because the elder siblings tend to get all the attention. And the Benjamin in the family is pampered and adored. So when we grow up, we find that we have all these pressures mounting up within the family unit, our own hopes for the future, the hopes and aspirations that are imposed upon us by our parents and others. And then there is the real world outside, and it's this conflict between what we want to achieve, all the aspirations that we have, and the demands of the real world, which cause many of the problems that we have in modern society. And this has always been one of those social questions that has fascinated me. How do we go about ensuring that the next generation cooperates in a more peaceful way than has often been the case in the past?
Yes, it is an interesting question, isn't it? Because I think it's very easy for adults to think that their generation was the best in the way. You know, a lot of people look back in the past with rose-tinted glasses thinking, oh, you know, we had it right and children today and that kind of thing. You hear it a lot, don't you?
Yes, it's very curious that we all need a certain degree of nostalgia. It actually fires our determination to go on making a better tomorrow, because we tend to look back, and rightly or wrongly, we pick out certain elements from the past which we liked, which we enjoyed, which gave us the impetus that we need for our lives. We tend, as you rightly say, to look at these events through rose-tinted spectacles. But at the same time, it does give us the energy to try and go on improving what we regard in our own lives as somehow inadequate or faulty.
So can you tell us more about the title, The Woven Figure? Will that give it away?
Yes, of course. This is a quotation which comes from a poem by Louis MacNeice, who worked for the BBC for a long time. It's a poem called Valediction. And the woven figure really refers to one of these essential aspects of human psychology, which is that we have to accept ourselves as we are, even though we discover very often that there are things that we want to change. And again, to some extent, I've been influenced in my thinking here by an American psychoanalyst, a man called Eric Byrne, who wrote a very influential book called Transactional Analysis. And what he basically says in this book is that we learn a script for the rest of our lives during our childhood. And even though we might rebel against this script, it is so powerful in the way that it determines our emotional responses that we go on using the same methods of interaction with people throughout our lives. And this means that ultimately we are what life has made us. which brings me back to the woven figure. And we might pick at certain threads, and we might want to change aspects of our personality that we're not happy with, but that ultimately is impossible, because if you were able to do that, you would simply destroy the individual. So what you have to do is to accept yourself as you are. We are all woven figures in the sense that this is the warp and woof that we can look at. This is what life is made of us.
Oh, I like it. Great expression, great quote. If people want to get a copy of The Woven Figure, it's available to buy in the bookshop section on our website, tre.radio. It's by Alexander Hall, who we've been chatting to. Alexander, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Hannah. All the best.
TRE. Talk Radio Europe. TRE. The Book Programme. Presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is Hannah Jameson, who wrote her first book at the age of 17. Q magazine described her as writing like an angel on speed. She's worked for the NHS and travelled the USA, Japan and Europe, developing a particular interest in the US, which led her to studying for a BA in American history. Now aged 28, she's with us on the book show to talk about her novel, The Last. It's a work of speculative fiction that makes you question where your morals lie and what sort of person you'd be when the world you've always known no longer exists. Welcome to the book show, Hannah.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Pleasure, thanks very much for joining us. So you wrote your first book at the age of 17, that's amazing.
Thank you. I guess I suppose it looks very, very productive, but it was just because I was extremely unpopular at school and had this kind of long-term revenge strategy where I thought if I become really famous, then, the guys at secondary school would probably want to date me. So truly, my whole career has been a result of spite and my bloody-mindedness.
And did it work? Do the boys want to date you now? I hope so.
Yeah, weirdly, it did actually come off. Like, a guy who I had a massive crush on at school did actually get back in touch when this book got sold and asked me out. I didn't reply or nothing came of that, but I thought, wow, like, I wish I could go back 10 years ago and tell younger me that it did actually work.
Oh, that's amazing. So looking at the story of The Last, I think it sounds like a great concept. Just explain, sort of without giving too much away, what happens in the book.
The Last is basically a murder mystery set in the months immediately following the outbreak of nuclear war. And it's narrated by a stranded American academic who is in a hotel in Switzerland with 20 other survivors. It's basically a dystopian murder mystery.
And the idea is that somebody is murdered in the hotel, and then this John works out that obviously one of these people left over is a murderer and has to find out who it is.
I think the reason people keep comparing it to Agatha Christie is because it's got that cast of suspects in a closed environment. So, yeah, it's implied the murderer is, and it has to be someone in the hotel. So he starts investigating all of the guests one by one and interviewing them and finding out what they were doing when the war broke out and all the communications went down. So that's how it plays out without giving too much away.
Yeah, great idea. Where did the whole idea come from, do you know?
Well, I had about 14,000 words of a hotel murder mystery written, but I didn't have the kind of right framing for it, and I had particular scenes, but I didn't feel excited by it. I didn't feel like propelled through a novel, and something about it just wasn't working. And then I started writing this book immediately, kind of after the 2016 US presidential election. And it was mostly inspired by the fact that everyone was making these really dark nuclear war jokes on social media. And And I thought that was really interesting. And then it kind of all fell into place like that. I thought that would really bring the hotel murder mystery to life if it had an end of the world framing. And that was something I felt like I wanted to write about that subject anyway, like the collapse of civilization. It's something that's really interested me.
Yeah.
It was a project I had anyway, but sometimes you just need that extra idea to turn it into something completely different.
Mm. And have you written it in a way that it's believable, as in it's something that could actually happen?
I don't
hopefully
want
not, but
but yeah, it's plausible. It obviously could happen. It's like, you know, which end of the world scenario is gonna get us first? Is it gonna be nuclear war? Is it gonna be AI? Is it gonna be climate change? Jokes. It's gonna be climate change. But yeah, I mean, people who've read it have said it feels scarily plausible. So I can only go on what they say, really.
Yeah. And what about the characters? How important were coming up with the different characters?
Well, characters are kind of the most important part of any writing project for me, anyway. Because if I don't care about the characters, it doesn't matter how good a plot is. I won't finish a book if I realise I don't care what happened to them. Like John, the main character, the reason he ended up being a historian was because I wanted the end of the world recorded in that kind of self-conscious record keeper kind of way. And there aren't many jobs that lend themselves to that kind of disposition. Like, he could have been a journalist, he could have been, he could have been a creative writer. But I thought there was just something about him being a historian and sort of locating the end of the world in that particular context. And sort of being involved in the sequence of events as he was writing them. I thought that would just come off as really interesting.
Yeah. And what about the setting?
The Switzerland hotel.
Yeah.
I knew I wanted it to be remote. And I also knew it had to be somewhere that wouldn't be in a blast radius. So I just kind of had a look at a map of Europe and thought, where might escape, where isn't near any major cities, where, you know, which places wouldn't be hit. And I worked out that if you really were that far out and away from a major city, you could probably survive for, you know, some sort of indeterminate length of time before radiation hit. So that influenced where I located it. And also because I wanted that kind of horror of the setting, in that they're too far away to actually get anywhere. So it's a sense of being very claustrophobic, but also very trapped in a very wide open space. And I wanted that kind of juxtaposition, that clash of emotions.
Yeah, absolutely. So tell me about studying American history. How much history do they cover?
Pretty much everything from when the Westerners arrived and started colonizing everything. That was when it started, when I was doing my degree. But I never finished that degree. I'm technically a university dropout. I dropped out at the beginning of my second year. Well, I deferred and then I dropped out because I realized I couldn't fulfill writing books 2 and 3 and finish a degree at the same time. And also because my university was incredibly rigid and just would not let me do it. Which was kind of annoying, but I'm finishing off my degree now, but I'm doing it with the open so that I can do it around everything else. And also, God forbid I make anything easy for myself, I've just added a degree to my workload.
Why not? And other than obviously getting enjoyment from it, studying American history, do you plan to kind of do anything with it?
Yeah, I would love to go back to studying American history and do something with it at a post-grad level. But that's something I can't think about for another couple of years because the degree I'm doing is something part-time. But I mean, I would love to go off and embark on some kind of non-fiction project in a few years' time. That would be amazing.
So this is presumably a standalone. Are you looking at doing another novel on something completely different?
I'm writing book 5 right now. I started it at the beginning of the year. And it's not a sequel, but it's probably in the same, it's the same tone. It's a dystopian thriller, but very near future dystopian. There's a particular brand of of the genre that I really enjoy, and that's probably J.G. Ballard is probably emblematic of that. Because his version of dystopia is basically our society as it is now, but just, you know, kind of skip into the future, and maybe the, you know, the brightness and contrast are turned up a little bit, but it's not, it's not a jump into absolute sci-fi. It's a world that's incredibly recognisable. And that's the kind of near-future dystopia that I want to write. So I am writing another book in that same genre, yeah.
Fantastic. Well, if people want to get a copy of The Last, it's available now on our website in the TRE bookshop section. It's by Hannah Jameson, who we've been chatting to. Hannah, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, no worries. Thank you. It's been great.
The Book Programme. Presented by Hannah Murray. TRE.